I want to talk about differentiation. Yesterday, I introduced the sort of mathematics behind space-time and talked about formalizing our concept of space-time in a curved space-time as an infinitely differentiable curved manifold. So now I want to revisit all the different ways that we can take derivatives of geometric objects on our manifold. So there are various different ways of seeing what can go wrong when you actually try and differentiate. And so I'm going to start with a rather pedestrian one, which you probably saw when the connection was introduced. But I'm going to say, suppose we just try to do the naive thing, the thing that in normal three-dimensional sort of standard Cartesian geometry is like grad, which is sort of d by dx in the x slot, d by dy in the y slot, and so on. So suppose we just tried to take one of our vectors. So for this piece, this part, I'm just going to be using our sort of standard index notation, and we just try to take a partial derivative. So why might that be not a good thing to do? So let's imagine that what we're doing is taking it in some primed coordinate basis. And so we have our standard expression for a contravariant transformation rule. So we're taking our mu primed index on V into just the mu index. And then, of course, for the partial derivative, I can simply use the chain rule. So I've just expanded that out. So when I take a partial derivative, I'm not only taking the partial derivative of the components of V in the other system, but I've also got to take a derivative of the transformation matrix. And so I end up with two pieces. This second piece here is exactly what I would expect if this object here was some sort of tensor, let's say S mu prime, mu prime. So I might sort of say that this part plus that would give me something like S mu prime would be the right transformation rules. So this would be a mixed tensor. However, we have this additional piece. And so this is telling us that the left-hand side is not a tensor. So that's one way of motivating the introduction of the connection. However, another thing that you could do is you could look at this extra term, which is making this S fail to be a tensor, and you could notice that it's actually symmetric in mu and nu, because partial differentiation is symmetric. And so another thing that we can think of if we're trying to construct a geometric object is we can think of trying to construct a way of differentiating which is anti-symmetric. And so that's what I'm going to do. So this is just a sort of way of motivating something which we're going to call D. So D is going to be an anti-symmetric derivation, and with any luck, we'll be able to construct derivatives of geometric objects without having to have a connection on the manifold. So let me just start by introducing it in a relatively simple context before going and actually trying to discuss what it means in general. So for this early bit of the discussion, I'm simply going to be keeping more with indices. So if I want something anti-symmetric, I don't really want to have a mixed object here. I want to have all my indices on the same level, okay? Can I just check, did you see this notation that the square bracket, yeah, okay, good. So, because you want to construct anti-symmetric objects, you're basically going to be looking at the differentiation acting on covariant geometrical quantities, and the simplest covariant object is just a covector. So we want to have whatever this d omega is, we want to have this property so if I take d of omega and ask what are its components, the obvious thing to do is to just anti-symmetrize a partial derivative. So you can sort of see that in the context of the coordinate transformations, although I wrote it down for a vector, you can see how that will kill any extra term. So at least for covectors, we're okay. We know how to take a derivative without having to have any connection. So this is something that's geometric. So how can we extend that to a more general class of geometric objects on the manifold? So the key here is to note this word, anti-symmetry. So what we need to do, it's no point in trying to take an anti-symmetric derivative of a symmetric quantity, because essentially if you have something symmetric and you try to anti-symmetrize it, you just get zero. So we need to start with something that's completely anti-symmetric. So this leads us to a discussion of differential forms. So differential forms are going to be, in essence, these are completely anti-symmetric. Covariant objects. So mathematically, when you construct a tensor, a sort of tensor product on a space, you do it by taking, for example, if you just wanted to look at rank two tensors, you take it by looking at a sort of all the things spanned by just combinations, pairing up vectors. So it's not that you can represent all tensors as just two, you know, a pair of vectors, but the space of tensors is constructed from things where you just pair up vectors. And it's the same thing with forms. You construct the space of forms by taking anti-symmetric products of vectors, and that spans the space of forms. So we need to construct this anti-symmetric product which is the wedge product. So it's like usually denoted by just a little wedge. So, for example, alpha wedge beta. Would simply be take the product of tensor product of alpha and beta and then subtract off the anti-symmetric part. So that's the idea of what the wedge product is. So if I put it in components, because it's usually sort of easier to see than this notation. If I wanted to look at the components of alpha wedge beta, it would be alpha mu beta nu minus alpha nu beta mu. And so in general, so that's a general expression. So in this case, P and Q are the rank of the forms. In other words, alpha is a rank P covariant anti-symmetric tensor. So it's got P indices, and it's completely anti-symmetric on them. And so all you're doing from the perspective of components is you're putting together the alpha and the beta, and then you're anti-symmetrizing on absolutely everything. So both alpha and beta separately are anti-symmetric, and all you're doing is sort of shuffling around the indices and making sure the whole product is also anti-symmetric. So this wedge product is obviously just a multiplication of sorts, but it's not a commutative multiplication. So it's not as simple as being anti-commutative. It's obviously anti-commutative when it's acting on one forms, but it depends on the rank of the form. If alpha and beta were two forms, then it would actually be symmetric. So you get a minus sign every time you pass. So in order to put, say, if you look over here, it's probably easiest to see this with the index expression. If you wanted to push beta through onto the other side of alpha, it means you've got to take all of these B indices and push them over to the other side. So you're taking every B index and swapping it through successively all of the A's. So this is just a permutation. And so you get a minus sign to the P every time you pull a B index through the A. And then you've got Q of them, so hence minus to the PQ. And so this gives us now some way of actually defining our space of forms. And so we denote So just as we had TP of M, sometimes you see it as a sort of lambda P of M. So because we're doing this anti-symmetrization, we can't just keep going on ad infinitum constructing P forms. So the reason is that if we're in a finite dimension manifold, because we're doing this anti-symmetrization, there's only a finite number of choices for every value of our index. So once we hit n, once p plus q is n, the dimension of the manifold, we can't go any further. So there's a maximum size for the form. And an N form is actually really, essentially, there's only one way that you can have an N form, because you simply take A1 is X1, A2 is X2, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's really only one independent choice for your set of N indices. So the N forms really are all just multiples of a single sort of basic object. N forms are, I guess. So our n forms are really just a functional multiple of this single basic, completely anti-symmetric n index object. And so this epsilon with no curls, is simply the alternating tensor. So, well, shouldn't have said that word, should I? The alternating symbol on n indices. And it just gives you plus or minus one, depending on the permutation of the indices. So that's what epsilon is. It's not quite a tensor. So you probably met, the first time you meet it is in the context of epsilon ijk. But it's actually very nearly a tensor. It's quite interesting to see what happens to these objects under transformation. So let me just consider, for example, epsilon A1 AN, the alternating symbol, times DX A1 wedge DX AN. So I can say this is also, if I change basis, so I just change basis. My dx goes to dx by dy dy. That's what I get. And then I now look at this object here, and I notice that that's just the definition. That's how you define a determinant of a matrix. And so what I get is the following. So in other words, I just decided, this is not saying this is a geometric object yet, I'm just exploring what happens. If I take my alternating symbol and regard it as components of something to be determined, and I'm taking, this is my sort of n form coordinate basis, I change coordinates, my coordinate transformation matrix, I notice that this combination here gives me, by definition, the determinant of dx dy times the alternating symbol. And so here we've got, this was my sort of object I wanted to explore, and it's very nearly a tensor. It's gone into something that looks like itself times a determinant of the coordinate transformation matrix. And so this is what's known as a density. And so a density is something which under a coordinate transformation transforms like a tensor but with products of the determinant of the coordinate transformation matrix. So another object, if I skip forward a little bit, another object which transforms as a density is if I take the determinant of my metric components, then under a coordinate transformation, so det g a prime b prime, so if I take a determinant of my of a rank 2 covariant tensor, Then under a coordinate transformation, because these components transform covariantly, what I'll get is the determinant in the unprime basis times the determinant of the coordinate transformation squared. So that's another example of one of these densities. And so I can put that together with this expression here to construct a covariant object. So my geometric object, which will sort of be using my epsilon tensor, I simply take the alternating symbol and add a root g. And so that now transforms covariantly, yes? So we talked about that yesterday when we were doing the coordinate bases. And so when I talked about the dual basis, so it's actually in the notes from yesterday, we actually showed why this dx mu was the dual basis to the coordinate vector basis d by dx mu, by showing that if mu was not equal to nu, then dx mu by dx nu is zero. And if mu equals nu, dx mu by dx mu is 1. And so it had exactly the right properties to be the dual basis. So if you have a quick look back at that part of the notes, you'll see why that is the basis, the coordinate dual basis. So, yeah. Because I'm talking about forms at this point. So when I'm talking about the epsilon there, what I wanted to do was I started off by saying that the n form is a multiple of this completely antisymmetric object. And I said that at the epsilon, I just defined the alternating symbol. It's either plus or minus 1, depending on the permutation of the indices. But then I wanted to explore whether that could be made into a tensor. And so that's what I'm doing on the left-hand board. I'm simply taking, I wrote down an expression. I said I didn't know what it was, whether it was covariant, geometric, or whatever, but I wanted to just see what happened. So I was simply writing something down as a guess and seeing whether or not it was geometric. So my first guess, which was taking the epsilon symbol with a coordinate basis, didn't actually work under a change of coordinates, but it didn't work by a factor of the determinant of the coordinate transformation. And that's quite a familiar, that's actually a familiar type of quantity to crop up. And so that tells me that in fact, maybe I wasn't so stupid to have done this in the first place. And so another example of an object, in this case something scalar, a determinant, also doesn't transform covariantly, but it also has this factor of the determinant. And so these objects, if you want to keep to keep them in, but simply say their densities, you can say, well, they transform as a covariant transformation, but you get products of the determinant. Or you can simply say, well, actually, I'll define this tensor. And I've added in that factor of root g to make the transformation work properly. So the thing about the epsilon tensor, and note it does need a metric to actually define it, is that just as the n forms, there's only one linearly independent type of n form, you can sort of see that that's a bit like just having a function. It's a function times this alternating type of object. And so one forms, or covectors, have a sort of like a whole sort of n degrees of freedom, are a bit like n minus one forms. And so what this epsilon tensor does is allow us to make a relation between p forms and n minus p forms. And so we define cos alpha. So that's simply how we relate p forms to n minus p forms. So it's called a dual. This is like a duality operation. And so this is known as the Hodge dual or the star operator. So that's a little bit about forms, just sort of saying what they are, basically antisymmetric covariant tensors. A little bit about the space of forms, lambda p, and about ways of operations between different spaces, although you do need a metric to do that duality. So now let's go back to the exterior derivative. So if we look at where I first talked about a completely antisymmetric derivative that was a geometric object, it took, that's right at the top there, it took the covector omega to an antisymmetric rank 2 tensor. So in the language of forms, it took a 1 form to a 2 form. And so in general, this exterior derivative is going to take a p form to a p plus 1 form. Yep. Yep. Sorry, the... Sorry, this one? Oh, this. What do I mean by this statement? A volume form. It's really closely related to the volume form. So I'm still not sure I'm getting your question. No, I think it's just me. I'm just not getting what the question is. So in this case, all I'm doing is, what I'm trying to sort of say is, what I was doing was exploring what epsilon could do. So these, the epsilon with the indices is just, it's simply a number. It's either plus or minus 1. And I wanted to see, can I construct a geometric object out of that number? So my P form I represent as a set, I can either represent it as my alpha underlined, or I represent it as a set of components. So it's again, it's sort of, probably maybe this is coming to this index notation thing. So here I'm saying epsilon A, B, C, D, et cetera, is a number. I'm going to try and construct an N form out of it, by simply saying that epsilon are the components, that those numbers are the components of something in the coordinate basis. So all I'm doing here is saying, if I construct a geometric or a supposedly is it a geometric object? If I construct an object by taking these numbers with this coordinate expression, what do I get? And what I get is something which is a density. So as you say, if this is really like the volume form, no big surprise, is it? Because if you've got something that's a volume form, you do a coordinate transformation, you expect to get the Jacobian. So it, in some ways, I think you might be perhaps reading or looking behind just what I've written here. What I was doing here was saying, let's just be naive, let's take these numbers, these as components, let's see if we write them down, what do we get? Is it something that's just hopeless under a coordinate transformation, or is it something that looks actually sensible? And it looks nearly sensible. And so what I was using that to do was to motivate the introduction of this curly epsilon, which is like the covariant proper, you know, proper tensorial object, which we then use to construct this duality map. So I think maybe I was being, you know, I was being less deep in there than you thought or something. I mean, I was simply motivating how to, you know, first of all, mentioning densities and motivating the curly epsilon symbol. So our exterior derivative is going to be a map between between P forms and P plus one forms, which is so it has to have a Leibniz type of property, and to reduce to partial differentiation on functions. So time and again, when mathematicians are defining differentiation of whatever ilk on a manifold, it always boils down to, it's a map from here to here, it's Leibnizian, it reduces to partial differentiation on functions, and then has certain sorts of properties. So that tends to be a sort of quite a common theme with definitions of differentiation. So it's rarely, oh, it has this sort of component. So df is simply df by dx mu, dx mu. So if I underline the d's, I could underline that d there, although you often don't. So that statement actually essentially completely specifies what this exterior derivative is. And so if I want to write it in components, so d of alpha, which is one of these p forms, then rather like the wedge product, you simply take the partial derivative and completely anti-symmetrize it. So that's going right back to that first object that I introduced. So if I take d of alpha wedge beta, p and q forms, then this is what I meant when I put the inverted commas around Leibnizian. You take your D, you act on the alpha, then you want your D to act on the beta, but to make it act on the beta, you've got to sort of pull it through the alpha, and that costs you P minus signs to do that. So an example of forms is actually gauge theory. So in electromagnetism, our gauge potential is that you can think of it as a one form. And then the field strength, F, is just going to be a two-form. And it's simply the exterior derivative of A. So although when you first meet electricity and magnetism, you think of them as two separate fields, you very rapidly learn in physics they're just part of a single object, and really what they are is just part of a rank two tensor, or this two-form F. And so the nice thing about writing things this way is half of Maxwell's equations become immediately obvious. So So the exterior derivative actually satisfies that if you act twice by it, you get zero again, because partial differentiation commutes. So we get half of Maxwell's equations for free. And then, of course, gauge invariance is simply we take our gauge field A and add D of a function, lambda, and then, of course, F goes to F plus D of D lambda, which is just F, because D squared is zero. Okay, so that took a bit longer than I expected. So that's one way of taking a geometrical derivative. So I also want to discuss another sort of derivative, but this is coming rather than thinking about sort of coordinate transformations, looking at what happens if you try and do the naive partial differentiation and then trying to cook a way of getting around it. There's another way you can take a derivative is to go back and think about what you mean by derivative. So just as a motivation, this example is going to be called the Lie derivative. So as a motivation, let's just think about what we mean by derivative. So if we're dealing with standard real functions and we want to take the derivative, you meet it as a limiting process. It's taking the gradient, really. It's just taking the gradient of a function, and it's defined as a limit. And you take your function, so you're looking for the derivative at x naught. You look at your function a little bit away from x naught. You subtract off what it is at x naught. So this is the incremental difference, delta f. And then you divide by delta x. And as long as, you know, as you let delta x go to naught, that particular ratio is well defined. It doesn't hop around all over the place. Then the limit is defined, and you call that the gradient. So if you wanted to do that on the manifold, there's sort of some slight sort of differences. So x naught would go to p, would go to some point on the manifold. So that's kind of obvious. But now you've got to ask, what do you mean by delta x? So that's the first sort of query that you come up with. What do you mean by delta x? And then if f is not a function, but some, say, vector or some geometric object, if f is a vector, this vector at some different point on the manifold is in a different vector space. So it's in a different vector space, so you have to worry about how to take this difference, because you can only add or subtract vectors in the same vector space. And so this is the way that you're led to constructing a connection on the space-time, because you want to take a vector space at p plus delta p and connect it back to the vector space at p, so that you can then do the subtraction and take the derivative. So looking at this expression and the difficulties of how to translate it onto a curved manifold lead you to other forms of derivative. So the connection comes from thinking about how to connect the tangent spaces together. But what I want to talk about right now is something called the Lie derivative, which is more about asking, what is delta x, or p plus delta p? And so the idea of the Lie derivative is that you take a derivative along a vector field. And so here, if this is our point P, and we imagine that we have a vector field V. So in other words, remember vectors were defined as tangents to curves. So I can think of the curve, a curve gamma, to which V is tangent all the way along gamma, and then a set of other curves to which V is always tangent. So then this gives me a way of moving to a new point. It gives me a way of having a very specific delta x. So I move a little delta t along the curve. So that's the sort of basic idea or the construction. And formally, what you're doing with this process is you're using the vector field V to kind of, at least locally, map the manifold to itself. So what you're doing is taking, say, or one way of thinking about it, is to take sort of this region of P, and then you propagate along these curves, these gammas, and that moves this neighborhood of P up to a new part of the manifold. So if I say I have another vector field here, U, so that's the sort of idea in what you're actually, what you're doing. So let's just think about what I said there about moving along these curves of V. So I'm thinking of my motion along the vector field V as a coordinate transformation. So I'm sort of constructing locally a little coordinate transformation by moving just a tiny bit along those curves of V. So you can think of it as a new chart on the same old manifold, or you can think of it as actually kind of shifting. So I can then think under this coordinate transformation, what happens to my, you know, the vector field I want to take the derivative of. So if I take the derivative of this coordinate transformation, I simply get a delta mu nu from the first piece, and then an order delta t part, which is the derivative of v. And so now I can go back to my expression here and say, can I now sort of find a way of finding this delta, delta u? So if I look at my expression for the derivative, what I can do is I can take the field u at the point x delta t, and then I can look at u as it's been transformed under the coordinate transformation. So I guess that's that pushed forward of version of u. Get my indices straight here. So what I end up with is something which again involves partial derivatives and is completely geometric. So if under, you know, in terms of the way in which, if I'm looking at this from the covariant contravariant coordinate transformation perspective, then this is a tensorial object. Now, u and v here are both vectors, and so, again, notice the antisymmetry. And another way of writing this for vectors specifically is as a bracket, so it's actually a commutator. So a geometric way of defining this is that for every single function in C infinity of M, the Lie bracket acting on a function is VU minus UV. So you see there why I mentioned, called the word commutator, because it literally is just the anti-symmetric action of the two vectors. The real difference with looking at it as the Lie derivative is that the Lie derivative can act on covectors, on tensors, whereas the Lie bracket is really just an algebraic structure on vectors, on TP of M. So I'll just write down the expression for A in terms of components. So if I've got a covariant object, then it's v mu d mu omega nu plus, so you can see this by taking the Lie derivative of, say, the contraction of a covector with a vector. And then for more general rank tensors, so for a general object, you would see, first of all, you'd start v mu d mu of q. So you'd start off, you always start off by taking the partial derivative along the vector. Then for every contravariant index, you take I don't remember which way around this goes. So I hope this is obvious. I'm trying to point out the pattern. It's always useful to spot patterns. The pattern is, in terms of components, for every contravariant index, you're always subtracting. And what you see is you take the contravariant index, you make you sum over that particular index with the partial derivative, and you swap that free index onto your V. So that's how you do it for the contravariant ones. And then for the covariant ones, you're simply replacing the free index as the partial differentiation index and summing in the opposite way. So you're always starting off differentiation of object along V, and then plus or minus a differentiation of V summed over the independent indices of your object. It's exactly the same, and I've managed to completely mix my notation in a single expression. Yes, so that's not very good, is it? So I'm assuming you've seen, like, comma nu is d nu is d by dx nu, and semicolon is, of course, the covariant derivative. I think it's because it's right at the end of the lecture. I'm trying to get finished. So, yeah. Fair comment. Okay, so tomorrow we'll again review connections and covariant derivatives, and I'll say probably a little bit more about what the Lie derivative can do for you. And then I'll start talking about a slightly different way of computing connections, which is known as Cartan formalism.